difference between the credit-prone portfolio and the risk-free portfolio. So the mochi has to be, the amount that has to be added to the mochi is 110% at least of the difference between the risk-free matching asset portfolio and the default-prone asset portfolio. So essentially everything that we have saved by discounting the liabilities in a different manner has to be added and a little bit more into the mochi. This is spoiling the equation. And that is a fact that the technical provisions get larger, and therefore the available capital gets smaller. So that's how it works together. So get your cons checking that it is what it is. Now finally to the required capital. Recall that the mochi, we have just segregated the mochi into an unchanged insurance mochi that we forget about and the default mochi that I just talked about. And the default mochi, again, is 110 to 130% of the value difference due to the asset spread. So that's what we've seen before. Now, guess what? This also gives you the spread sensitivity. This default mochi is an extremely spread-sensitive animal. And whoever worked with PCDSs, I did credit portfolio management for a while, knows that this PCDS price is spread sensitive. And if you basically pick up all the risk, then it's just as sensitive as the spread. So that means that we have an additional balance sheet item that has just the spread sensitivity that we wanted to get rid of. And for that very reason, also the required capital goes up. It's mochi, the fluctuating mochi, the fact that the mochi becomes larger when the credit spreads widen, and it shrinks if they are narrowing. So also the required capital is larger if you discount with an asset spread. So essentially, that concludes, and that's just a slide that you've seen, that concludes the proof of the theorem. And I think I hand back.
Thank you, Lutz. Questions?
No.
So my simplistic view of the world is, according to Modigliani-Miller theorem, the structure of equity and debt should not matter for the value of a company. So what we're doing by discounting differently, we simply change the equity debt structure to the financing structure of a company, nothing more. So that should not change the value. Or you have just given a counterexample why Modigliani-Miller is not working. And then the only thing where I see it, that this is really adding cost, would be the frictional cost via the capital you have to hold.
Correct.
It's only a second order effect that would bring this to a disadvantage, because the how you put up your balance sheet and what you call liability or debt or equity should not matter.
Yeah, and I'm also not arguing about that. I'm not changing debt to equity or anything. I'm just calculating part of the when it's just like happening within the insurance liabilities, and it's just like shifting one element from the marginal, from the current estimate to at least the margin of a current estimate, because I have different financing methods for that. And the impact goes like that. Due to the fact that I have a different financing measures and due to these guys asking the same kind of capital requirement, that capital requirement goes up. That's inevitable because there's additional risk in the runoff of the company. So therefore, it comes in, and therefore it works out.
I have a few comments. First, this is based on the premise that being able to transfer liabilities to a third party in a one-year time horizon is the best way to set up capital standard in some ways. Let me go on. If we as an insurance company, say, got into trouble and got into runoff, and we had to run off our liabilities, for the policyholder security, we obviously would need to hold capital in the runoff period. But I'm not sure my shareholders would be in a position to demand the same costs or return which a third-party acquirer would demand. So basically, the equity may have been wiped off, we are running off, so there's no additional cost of capital. And just a thought, that's a possibility, so we need to think about that a bit more. Secondly, the one thing which I don't have an answer to, but I've thought about, so again, it's, can't really react to all of it at one go. I think we at times forget that this is all a theoretical construct. There is no market to be consistent to, so we are using various financial theories to determine a value which can be put to the liabilities. And we are making a lot of assumptions when applying theory. So I don't have a rebuttal to the theory on how to calculate the cost of capital, Mochi, but the question is, if as an investor, someone offered post the stress, their liabilities with assets backing it equal to the best estimate liability plus cost of capital, Mochi, then I take it away. I will have some risk appetite. I will not invest it in risk-free. I will not keep it in risk-free. If I had to keep it in risk-free, why would I take it in some ways? So if I did invest it in like a normal, not-in-trouble insurance company did by investing in risky assets, in the real world, what return would I make? Would that be more than supernormal in that construct, or would that be less than supernormal? I've not done the math there. I'm just posing that as a question. I think that's for now.
There were a lot of questions, and I don't know whether I written them all down. But perhaps start with the point on the real investment. What I'm saying is about valuation of liabilities, and also my company, of course, invests into credit-prone assets in order to make money. There is a spread associated with them, and that means that you can earn money. The only thing is, it's not risk-free. So that is the reason why we all are not taking risk-free positions, but we are, as a going concern, making investments decision, and we have a position, and we have an idea whether the interest rates might raise or fall, and which equity pays off good, and we invest in those. So there is nothing wrong with that, and this is not at all affecting that. That just gives the baseline in a certain regulatory framework how that could be done. And all I'm saying is within that framework, and I think that relates to your first question, obviously you said like, okay, this is all kind of within a theoretical framework. And that's it's a pretty practical framework when it comes to Solvency II, SST, and when it comes to ICS. But if we want to do things in this framework consistently, then this is an observation that should be made. So fully appreciate that the real world out there has other considerations, and we all know that, for example, governments want insurers to invest into equity into corporate bonds, into infrastructure, and they are willing to set incentives for that. This is all not captured here, right? That comes on top of that, and that needs to be fitted into that. But from a pure prudential point of view, from the point of view of the prudential regulator, I think there's no doubt. I think it was a final question about the existing shareholders in a runoff situation. When I look at these two things, you either do it comes to a going concern situation, and you have the opportunity to transfer the portfolio so that it runs off with somebody else's portfolio, or you're running it off on your own. There are two things, and you have like this moral idea of, well, there are existing shareholders and we're not sure whether they can ask the same return. All the investors that I have seen, especially after a crisis or when a company went into some difficulties, they will ask for the same return. They will even ask for more in order to get that done. And they don't care at all whether they are existing shareholders or new shareholders, because they can sell their shares like that and acquire them like that. So I don't buy into that. For the comparison between the transfer and the runoff in the own company is, from a risk point of view, running it off with some other liabilities is always better, because we're talking about runoff risk, and that runoff risk should diversify with other risks. I mean, this is beneficial. And after some time in a runoff company, you basically have liability risk. In a combined carrier, you have liability risk and life risk, and after waiting a couple of more years, you just have life risk remaining. So it would be stupid to run it off themselves on their own. So that is the reason why the Mochi here, being able to facilitate the standalone runoff, will always be also fit for transferring the business.
That's where I think we start blurring between theory and reality again. So if we are thinking of what would happen in real terms, where do transactions happen on best estimate liability plus 6% cost of capital Mochi? Do they always happen on that basis? If that was the case, why would anyone buy or do pensions transfers, bulk annuities transfers? So, like, again, the thing is, again, the distinction between reality and theory here, to my mind, is pretty steep.
Okay. The answer to your question, who would buy that? We, for example. Swiss Re does. We buy closed books of life business. We buy them at best estimate liability. We don't ask the 6% because we can diversify them with our other stuff in running them off. So that's I think the answer to that question.
Can I get some reaction from the OIT group? We've been very vocal yesterday, so. No one attended from an OIG day to a risk-free rate day.
Can everybody identify themselves before they speak for the people on the phone?
Yeah. So this is Reinhard Eckel from Allianz, and we are part of the OIG group. Having heard all this, it's hard to reply on a formal basis, but maybe from a framing perspective, I would say if we would be discussing the theory of examining a transfer price of a portfolio, and we would be talking about investors and how they should invest their money in businesses, this is a valuable discussion, I think, but I think the OHG is explicitly not designed to simulate a pure transfer perspective. It's more in the general context of providing a measure of financial health of a company. And there, Your talk is about really the transfer perspective, while the OIG is more acknowledging that it's not merely the transfer perspective that's relevant.
Uh-huh.
It's more a going concern perspective. Maybe it's not in the middle. The OIG is more to the other side. It's more a pure going, or it's more emphasizing going concern perspective. So I think while it might be very valuable from this market consistent perspective, what you exposed here, I'm not sure that the exercise of an ICS is representing a shareholder and investor perspective.
So thank you very much for that comment. I pretty much agree with everything you said, in the sense that even if a regulatory regime like ICS or like becoming ICS, the standard, or Solvency II or SST is a going concern principle, they always calculate the cost of holding capital, and it may be called margin over current estimate, it may be called risk margin or market value margin, no matter. They always calculate that in this runoff view. That's the only thing, and you rightly point that out, that is calculated in the runoff view, in this regulatory framework. And I think as I gave the reasoning, the regulatory reasoning, when I gave the answer to Abhishek, that is for sure sufficient to ensure a standalone runoff of the liabilities so that the valid interests of the policyholders are not impaired. And you're absolutely right, this is not going concern, that is gone concern.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to conclude with just probably we will need an intervention from Mac.
The reaction was totally unexpected, but we are insurers, so we have to address the unexpected request. So if your conclusion is the risk-free liability discounting is optimizing corporate value, I cannot disagree more with this statement. This means that I don't agree with it. So... And actually, probably as a long-term institutional investor, we may eventually invest in the share of the insurance company. But we do not invest in based on the value, which is discount with a risk-free rate, because we would like to hold that share for a long, long time. So we would like to make sure that this insurance company is able to pay the claim for a very long-term horizon. If I am a day trader, probably I know that all the other day traders, the short-term investors, might, based on the value discounted by the risk-free rate. In that case, I would probably take into consider that. And then if, for example, assume that the policyholders are investors on the mutual insurance company the same, insurance policyholders would like to make sure that this company is being able to pay the claim. So that means that this insurance company is able to grow with the macroeconomy for a long time, for a very long-term horizon. So if there are some assets which are growing, which have a potential for growth, I'd like to see that this company is able to grow, and that will be positively evaluated on this matter. So in that case, so we think that OAG is more in line with objective for the long-term investors on the shares when we see this. So this is very important matters. So even for the prudential perspective, insurance regulators should, for example, to make sure that the insurance company is maintain the financial condition for a long, long time. So if the insurance company take a position to, for example, give up all the future growth and just invest short-term asset liability matching in based on the risk-free rate, which is negative, by the way, in Japan. So, and then, So you just freeze everything, just like, so this is just, do you think it is like expected role of supervisors? If I am a supervisor, of course, we would like to see the balance of the future growth and the risk that they are assuming, and then we build the regulatory requirement which incentivizes correctly the insurance company to take a position which would be good in the long run, not just look at good at the given moment at this current interest rate environment. This is what I'm trying to say. So lastly, so do you know the movie called Frozen? So there's a song called Let It Go, but don't let it go, otherwise your opportunity would be frozen. Thank you very much.
Matti.
I'll be, Matti Peltonen from Federal Reserve, I'll be far less entertaining, but put your concept in context of ICS, where we already deduct for the credit risk with credit risk factors, and we deduct for it with the risk correction, which covers credit risk and all other risks. And then when you say that MOCI needs to cater for credit default risk, is that instead of or addition to where we already cover credit risk?
That is additional. It's a different. You have to calculate your. In order to calculate the MOCI, you just look at the liabilities and how they are replicated, and what kind of risk is not replicated because it's unexpected insurance risk or it's default risk if you replicate or match with default prone assets. So it's only for this safe runoff of the risk. What you are referring to are the factors that are taken into account in order to calculate the required capital. And for the required capital, that doesn't change at all. So the only thing that changes there is that this MOCI item, if you replicate with default prone assets, becomes spread sensitive, but otherwise nothing changes for the required capital calculation.
Yeah, but in effect, doesn't if we deduct risk correction and we account for the credit risk for credit risk factors, then doesn't the impact the discount rate go below risk rate if we you add those together?
That I can't comment on. That's a question to you guys.
Okay, thank you. I think we, Christina, you are the only thing between us and coffee.
I got the message. Just, I don't think we can just straightforward compare. So OAGs, what do you think? Matching adjustment users, what do you think? This is a big challenge. Because, I mean, this presentation shows a lot of concepts that are being discussed. We know that there are other concepts similar that already exist. But it also makes a number of assumptions. And one of the assumptions that it makes, just in the green box, it says discounting with a spread means that you increase required capital. Yes, if you assume that if you discount with a spread and also have to take a spread charge.
No.
But if you discount with a spread...
That's simply not true. I mean, for those MS assets that are matching the liability, there is no spread charge whatsoever because those assets that match the liabilities, they move in sync with the liabilities and there will never ever be a spread charge for them. The spread charge comes from the MOCI item that we necessarily have to introduce, and since that is spread sensitive, and to Mark's question, it's not about the policyholder, it's about the investor and the question what the investor is, so that's a prerequisite. We don't have this wonderful long-term investors, by the way, give me these street addresses and the names, that are not asking for the market price for credit risk. So this is an additional item. It creates that kind of sensitivity and it creates that charge. So it's a conclusion that the risk increases if you take the prerequisites. So it's not an assumption.
But do you account?
No. I'm talking about the real spread risk. It doesn't matter whether you model it, how you model it isn't important here.
But do you charge for it or not, or never? You don't charge for it here. So
of
only the mulching.
Of course you charge.
That's in itself an assumption. So that's
no, it's not. I mean, when you want to manage your available, but when you want to manage your available capital, and your available capital is spread sensitive, then you have to charge for it. How can you otherwise manage it? That is.
Anyway, could we continue? But I just wanted to say that we can't just simply compare. I mean, we have had all these discussions in solvency plan, you know very well. Probably all these concepts should be discussed separately, but then brought all together. And also, we need to check the link between risk-neutral projections and then real world.
Yeah, you have to appreciate that sometimes there is a bit of Schadenfreude from our side of the table, which because sometimes you fight between yourselves and don't attack us, we will be better. So coffee break, guys. 15 minutes, yeah.
So, this is why you want to measure the run. This is why while everybody's
conversation will be recorded.
So, you know, you'll notice that the CRO forum had a globe on there as part of their picture, but it was more Eurocentric. It's nothing, not intentional. This is more North and South America centric. But so I'm Dave Sandberg, and I'm the chair of the International Escrow Association's Insurance Regulation Committee. So we've had a long time interest in the question of capital standards, going back at least 15 years that we've been in various conversations with the IAS on this topic. So I don't know about you guys, but it was great to see that somebody else cares about Moji. So I actually was, my wife, who has no interest in actuarial matters, about 6 weeks ago exploded one day, says, "I hate Moji. Everybody's talking about Moji." And I kind of stepped back and said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Japanese ice cream. I mean, it's just crazy how much people love it." I thought, okay, still not in the popular press. So, so what we wanted to do today was just share some observations. So point number one, we just had a very good demonstration. There are strongly held diverse views on both the determination and meaning of a Moji and also the most relevant financial basis. So the conversations that have occurred within the IAS walls and within the stakeholders also occur within the IAA. So we have regulators and former regulators from Europe, from North America, actuaries that have worked in many international contexts. So these are, we're very familiar with kind of all the different issues. And we kind of started in August trying to say, well, what could we say or recommend about a Moji? And we started going down a path and realized that maybe the most important thing is not to come up with a recommendation right away, but maybe let's just step back and say, what is it we're really trying to accomplish with a Moji? And so we suggested that, one, let's set up a set of considerations, recognizing that whatever method is used, no method will meet all the considerations, but it kind of gives us a sense for these would be desirable outcomes to have. Particularly, an understanding of the shortcomings would then allow you to link it to the qualitative aspects of ComFrame. We get kind of debating what the how to keep the number, and was said earlier today, we really want to link this to qualitative pieces when we find that there's some simplification or shortcut has been used. And lastly, what we'll go through here, this is not meant as a closed set. We've been kicking this around for the last couple of months. Other suggestions or feedback on these would be certainly welcome from both the IAS community and the larger stakeholder community. So obviously, would it be well-defined? Consideration number one, is it well-defined in a company with required disclosures that are helpful? So how to calibrate it, how it gets released over time, how it impacts future and reported future income, and how it reacts in changing conditions, particularly in a non-cyclical manner. So think about the question of what does it mean? So we've just had a discussion that said, I'm an outside investor, and I want to be compensated for my risk. And so we've defined a risk. Let's say we're saying in this case the risk-free rate is 6%, 1% risk-free, 5% extra risk. Now, reality as an investor, what the market value of a Moji is saying is that if all of the assumptions that are in today's market are true, in other words, the whole sense of risk and volatility and all of its characteristics, whether I'm in a very risky day or a very safe day, it says in that environment I've priced the market, and if all those assumptions play out, I will get a 6% return. Okay, it's an easy number. That makes it an easy number. It's maybe not easy for some, but it allows a calculation number to come out. So we've been asking ourselves at the IA, what does that really mean? So think about if I were an investor and I said, and someone gave me an investment opportunity and they said, you have the opportunity here to achieve a risk-free rate plus 2%. You say, oh, I'm supposed to get 6%. You say, wait a minute. I can demonstrate that going out to the 99th percentile, your variance in that will be 1.8 to 2.2 above a risk-free rate. If I were an investor, I would snap that up in a minute, right? And say, oh, my gosh, I'm going to get risk-free plus this almost guaranteed return. If, on the other hand, I said, oh, I can give you an 8% return, but there's a 20% chance you lose everything, and, you know, unless I'm a private hedge fund investor, man, I don't want to take those kinds of bets, but it's a very different kind of perspective. And so one of the first things we kind of came to think about is, what is this really saying about the tail? What does that say about the tail? So that's going to help us define what it is when we start to help us as we define what it is we're trying to calculate in Emochi. Second of all, do the balance sheet items and the disclosures show explicit amounts at key levels of aggregation? In other words, we can get an aggregate Emochi, but do I understand what's the Emochi on these, on either legal entities in different countries or on lines of business? And this will have some relevance here in a minute. Third of all, so we're in consideration three for those that are listening in. Do the performance statements, capital accounts, and disclosures indicate how and why Emochi and the capital is increasing or decreasing? So we had a discussion earlier today about internal models. And many, there's an ingrained skepticism, having been through the financial crisis and seen Wall Street models that failed to account for the risk that was in those, in the assets that they were dealing with. The failure of that is a validation failure, because I'm just pricing it. There's no ability to indicate why the price might change, why it's decreasing or increasing. I just would, you know, the assets would be priced and sold to somebody, and they say, okay, here it is. But there's no follow-up. There's no ability to say, well, how does this risk change over time? So we'd like to be able to see, as the Emochi is calculated over time, how and why is it changing? Is there consistency among those that will be calculating it? So this is obviously a question, one of the debates on IFRS 17. There's a lot of latitude principles. Will there be a process that allows there to be some consistency to come together over time? We're not trying to answer that question at this point, but we're just saying that's an important consideration. One of those being, for example, is the own assets with guardrails method. Is it actually compliant with IFRS, and can it be usefully evaluated in the field test? And I'll let the others address that question that are involved in that. But I think that's the other piece that we're trying to fit into this. Going back to this, and obviously if there are shortcomings with the own assets with guardrails, what are they and why are they there? And then if so, is there some place that they should be addressed within the qualitative aspects that will be there? I think this is probably the important one that I think we're kind of coming to more and more as a group. And again, we're presenting these as our current conclusions and thoughts. We've had some pretty vigorous discussions on our own, but we think that you really should start with audited financial statements, and then any adjustments to values should have some kind of double entry process so that they're explainable. So I was talking earlier about models. Models that are used in financial reporting have a validation process that you go through, and there's always a change. You know, last year's change in this number to this year's was caused by we sold a block of business, there was a change in interest rates, there was a change in mortality patterns, there was a change in policyholder behavior. We decided to use a different strategy for how we manage the business. I mean, there's all these ways you go back and you can explain and reconcile and say, oh, I was here. How did I get to here? So if Emochi changes, where does it come from? And as we talked a little bit about, what's the impact on deferred tax assets and the taxation piece as well? So, So think about if I am pricing a product today in a 2008-2009 environment, the market is basically saying it's really risky out there. And so 2 years later, the market view on risk has changed. So is my Emochi shrinking considerably? Am I getting a pro-cyclical Emochi? Or am I using Emochi more like an IFRS 17 that's basically a set charge that's being run off in a consistent manner over the life of the business? So these are, and the other is that when we think about transitioning from IFRS 17 to here, IFRS 17 is trying to report income consistently over a period of time. So again, this idea that I can get a levelized mochi or risk margin that's being run out over the risk makes sense from a performance standpoint from period to period. If as a solvency perspective, I'm really understanding, want to know what's happening in the tail. I'm really trying to understand where could the tail change dramatically, and is this something that could impact the business? Going back to the earlier example, if my actual dispersions of returns are quite large, that's a solvency question. If the dispersion is somewhat bounded, then I don't really care until I come across something that says, well, no, the conditions have changed, and there is a possibility it could be much more bounded. So it's making sure we're able to translate from a performance over time question to one that says, have I understood the nature of the tail risk, and is this something that's a solvency issue? So this just want to document, share with you, these are discussions we've had so far. So what's next? What are we trying to do? First of all, feedback from anyone that says, are there any missing considerations that you think would be relevant? And then some questions about practically, what would mochi be used for? It's likely that you would not sell an entire IAG to another buyer. I mean, they hit a snag, and you say, we're going to sell AIG or Allianz or Munich and say, they're on the market. There's just not a market for that. What's likely to happen is it's a specific country. It's a specific type of risk. Maybe it's been writing cyber risk, and they realize, oh, we've grossly miscalculated that. So you're going to end up either limiting or selling off certain lines of business. The other thing is that we're getting very focused on getting a precise number to calculate for a mochi, and it may add 2 to 3 or 4% to a balance sheet at the end of the day, depending on whether you're property and casualty or life. There's some important differences there. But the other interesting thing is that when we go back and look at aggregation and correlation, we're seeing 30 to 50% decreases in just the capital that we add up, piece by piece. If we have the capital, so now I've got this huge discount, and we say, well, we've got a correlation matrix. It's got 25, 50, 75, and we'll assume that's, somewhat accurate. But we think it's important to be saying, let's have this conversation in the context of what's happening with aggregation, because what aggregation also tells you is, going back to the question of selling off a line of business, if I have a line of business that's in trouble, there's likely someone else who has a correlation or diversification that's different than my company. And so, therefore, the price is not, there's not an objective market out there that says, oh, everybody in the market's going to buy this same piece for the same price. It's saying there's a variance of investors. And so we want to make sure that the information in mochi becomes useful as a disclosure item, as a way of looking at risk. So, for example, at the company that I'm currently at, Allianz, we price under several lenses. So we have pricing that has to look at an economic balance sheet, looks at a solvency too, and looks at U.S. RBC, because I work in a U.S. company, has to compete with U.S. companies. And our parent can only be dividended back dividends based on U.S. statutory rules. So that's a real consideration. I'll leave one last comment, which is that we have typically found that when we price our products under both a Solvency II economic capital framework as dictated by our European parent and a statutory-based product that uses stress testing to understand the tail, that we get very similar decisions. We don't end up with a product that says, oh, we can't sell this in the U.S., but we could sell it in Europe or vice versa. We get very similar answers because at the end of the day, we're trying to think about stress testing to help us understand both short-term and long-term capital needs. It helps us understand, is this a risk, something that would put us in a recovery or resolution issue? Don't want that risk. And so we found that internally useful for us. In this case, what we're thinking is that one of the helpful things we'll be able to look through is thinking through, can we identify certain stress tests that become important to the specific supervisory college, as each company has different risk profiles and issues. And we talked about this a little bit earlier today when the question of ORSAs and relating to internal models. To the extent an internal model is disclosing the major assumptions and making transparent to a group of supervisors who are able to say, well, this organization believes that catastrophe risk is they're getting out of it. You know, we just can't insure it. I mean, that would be an interesting signal. Other companies are going into it. That's the first indication you'd get, wow, we really have something important to talk about. It's never going to be captured in a model. It's never going to be captured specifically by a number, but you're going to see it in the different ways that companies are starting to explore risks. And then you can identify some stress tests that could allow you to see it. And so I'll conclude with that kind of last point about, I think to me is a hopeful sign that if we're thoughtful about how we think about different systems and stressing the tail, we'll find that we can get some similar answers. So with that, questions from both this group here and the other group and reactions.
Okay, a couple of observations and possibly a question. One is, I mean, we are at a fairly advanced stage in our development of the ICS, and we're getting to a point where we have to make some choices about Mochi for version 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do that pretty quickly. I mean, our target is the February FSTC for, you know, conceptually where we'll go on this. I'm not getting a clear sense from the presentation of which way we should go. So I think that would be my first question. Second question is related to this one on stress tests, and it might be a quite a good segue into our next segment on ICPs 15 and 16, because within ICP 16 we have the ComFrame requirements, including author, and that includes requirements to do stress testing. So are you thinking about these stress tests in the qualitative sense of what's already in ComFrame?
Yeah. So first of all, we've written about 20 plus pages of what we think is a recommendation, and we wanted to step back and first say, are we thinking about this in the right way? The considerations that we thought were important, this is what's driving us, and certainly the idea that if I have something off an audited financial statement, that seems to provide some stability and a sense of making sure I'm understanding what's driving the Mochi. So our expectation is that within about 4 to 6 weeks, we'd have a formal paper that we could submit and share and say, here are, based on these considerations, these are some things we think would be helpful, both from a C-Mochi and a P-Mochi perspective. We're not trying to, you know, the idea being, given these considerations, if you're going to use these, then here's some important ways to ask questions about a P-Mochi, and here's some important ways to ask questions about a C-Mochi so we can actually start to get useful information for comparison. And second, for the stress testing, yes, which certainly is the expectation. That's the qualitative link that's being described there.
So it sounds like if you're talking about 4 to 6 weeks, sort of about the Nashville meeting time?
Yeah, certainly, yeah. Yeah.
We look forward to any further iterations.
Okay. We certainly would be willing to present something more, but I want to make sure we're kind of starting with the right kind of approach.
So it sounds like what you're getting at more is what the supervisors should do in their supervisory process college discussions, rather than what we should do in the design of the ICS. Would that be a
well? I would say that the design is something that should be providing value in the supervisory college. So, I mean, I it's interesting to me because 4 months ago I started to look to say, what does this number actually mean on a balance sheet? You know, independently, you know, as we said earlier, well, what does it mean in the P-Mochi versus C-Mochi? And all of a sudden I went, I don't think it means what we think it means. You know, that we've come up with some nice, easy ways to calculate it in both a P-Mochi and C-Mochi world, and they all kind of make sense. But once I step back and say, well, really, as an investor, is this telling me what I want as a supervisor? What's missing and what should I better understand about it? And that's kind of what's led us down this road. So,
okay.
thanks. In your one of your slides, you mentioned the I guess appealed to me a little bit, but the aggregation diversification benefit that goes into your Mochi, that should, I guess, again, if you're dealing with what a third-party investor would have, the third-party investor would look different from the other company. So you're suggesting that it might make more sense in this to use maybe an industry average or something in terms of the diversification benefits aggregation method or whatever you would use in a margin versus the own company's diversification margin. Is that correct?
I would say we've identified that's like a bigger question than Mochi to us. It's almost like, you know, how are we going to think about diversification and give that value? And it comes in because we keep saying Mochi is about what an outside investor would pay, and we haven't actually thought about, well, what motivates an investor, and is it another competitor that has a different mix of business? Is it a hedge fund that has a particular hedge that they are seeing that they can value? And so that's kind of where it's a little up in the air still, but that's kind of so no answer yet at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it could be another insurance company, it could be a bank, it could be a lot of things.
Yeah.
So, right, okay, thanks.
And it's maybe to put a little bit of prudent skepticism around the number, because the number is like, it's calculated, it's validated and verified, and we can say, yep, that's a number, and it kind of ties to a story that we think makes sense. But we always want to put some prudent skepticism around what it actually means.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Dave, one of your slides, one of your considerations was, is the OAG consistent with IFRS, mm-hmm. or what does that have to do with Mochi?
So one of the options would be to say there's a risk margin defined within IFRS, and if we just said that's the risk margin that's being used, and if OAG is seen as a methodology that fits both within an IIS and an IFRS context, then you have something that fits into a audited prepared set of comprehensive balance sheets. And part of my own education has been is that the value of a comprehensive set of balance sheets and income statements is they are meant to be seen as a whole, that just focusing on one number is often a bit too superficial or shallow, and so you want to be able to see the context and understand how things change over time. That's the discipline that's provided, is that it's a very good picture, it's always got some imprecision, but by seeing how it changes and moves over time, if it's done appropriately, then that's an informative process.
I see. I guess my comment would be that I doubt there will be any company that wants to use OAG for their IFRS 17 balance sheet.
Well, I don't know. That's the thing. We don't know either. But that's kind of where I'm just saying we're just sharing with you some of the questions and thoughts that have come to us as we've worked through that. So. We've got someone back here.
Tom Gibbons from Pacific Life again. Appreciate the comments. I think this is an obvious point going back to the standardization versus idiosyncratic concepts and differences in situations. But I would just point out that mutuals might face a different analysis when it comes to Mochi than stock-based companies.
And certainly the P&C question is different than the life. Exactly, yeah. And that's part of what we're trying to do is help make sure we break down the sub-pieces, because once we aggregate them up to a number, we get this number at the end of the day, and we go, well, this number may not mean the same across different entities because it's being compiled in a different way.
No more questions? Señor Calderón?
Dang, I thought between Luz and I, you know, this is an opportunity to say Mochi matters, you know.
What would like to say to that? Yeah?
You.
Oh, close to Jair. Oh.
Hi, my name is Ramon. This discussion will be brief and nowhere as interesting as the last 2 hours on Mochi. I begin with, I am, as I said, my name is Ramon, and I head up the ICP 15 and 16 review work stream. It's a work stream underneath the Capital Solvency and Field Testing Working Group. The public consultation package for ICPs 15 and 16 were released on the 8th of November of this past month. It included revised drafts of ICP 15, which is investments